Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scarsbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you two very different stories. One, a conversation with a bishop from Sri Lanka as Pope Benedict calls for peace and reconciliation in this South Asian island. The other, a feature to mark the Lateran Pax 80 years on by listening to the voices of some of those who were there, including that of the Pope of the time, Pius XI. And to end the broadcast, our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover, Father Reginald Foster. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. On Wednesday, at the end of his customary general audience with pilgrims from across the world, Pope Benedict XVI prayed that peace and reconciliation would come soon to Sri Lanka. That dear country, he stressed.
In quel caro paese.
In particular, he called for the protection of innocent civilians caught up in an increasingly bloody conflict.
Facciano il possibile per garantire l'assistenza ai feriti e la sicurezza dei civili.
In Sri Lanka, according to church sources, there has recently been intensified fighting between government forces and the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, who are trying to retain their last stronghold. Tamil rebels have been fighting there since 1983 in an effort to create an independent state for minority Tamils, claiming discrimination under successive governments led by the Sinhalese ethnic majority in a conflict which has since claimed 80,000 lives. But it's not just the Pope here in Rome to call for an end to the violence. Catholic officials in Sri Lanka also appealed to the Sri Lankan government and Tamil rebels to stop attacks on civilians in particular. Among them, one bishop from Jaffna, the northern tip of Sri Lanka, major theatre of the violence. His name is Thomas Savundarana Yagam, and he speaks to Emma McCarthy about the situation there. Just as Sri Lanka is celebrating its 61st birthday. Emma begins by asking Bishop Thomas if there's anything to celebrate at this point in history.
We are not part of the celebration because we cannot, when our own kith and kin are getting killed, celebrate the independence. In the Jaffna Peninsula, we are very much concerned about what is happening in the Mullathivu district because this is also part of the Jaffna, and nearly 300,000 people are trapped there and they are unable to come out. Since there is very intense war is taking place between the Tamil Tigers and the Ceylon government forces. Therefore, the people have got caught in between and they are unable to come out of this war. Therefore, many are getting injured and also a good number of them are dying owing to these mortar and shells firing by both sides. Therefore, it is a concern that there is civilian death taking place there and also big number getting injured owing to this warfare, and they are unable to receive medical help because the ICRC is unable to broker a passage for them to come to the hospitals. Therefore, they are also struggling very hard in mediate between the Tamil Tigers and the army to bring the injured people to receive medical attention.
What I find most interesting, perhaps, was a message that was released by the president of the Sri Lankan Bishops' Conference, Archbishop Gomez. And in his message, marking Independence Day, he says, "Victory in battle is not victory in the war." And he calls for greater integration of the various ethnic groups on the island and nation of Sri Lanka. One of the crucial aspects in the civil war, the current civil war that's ongoing, is the affirmation of the rights of minority ethnic groups, particularly Tamil minority. Many Tamils feel that the Sinhalese majority on the island do not recognize the full rights of the Tamil minority. The Jaffna Peninsula, if I'm not mistaken, and particularly the area where you operate your mission and your pastoral work, there is a Tamil majority. Are they really discriminated against?
Yes, we are nearly 20% of the total population. They form the Tamil minorities, and they are equally in this country and part of the island. They are not people who have come from somewhere else. So we are also equal citizens of this country. And also we feel that we are also a nation, since we have their own culture or land as well as our own language also. So we are a bit different from the majority who are Sinhalese, but nevertheless we feel we are part of this land.
What sets aside Catholic Church in Sri Lanka and the work of its bishops, priests, nuns and laity, the fact that the Catholic Church is inclusive and it tries to promote the idea of equality among the many different ethnic groups that make up the nation of Sri Lanka. How important is the Catholic Church's presence for the promotion of integration and perhaps the promotion even in a certain way of the beginnings of a future of peace for the island?
All the Buddhists are Sinhalese. And the Tamils are among the Catholics also. Therefore, there are Tamils and Sinhalese among the Catholics. So we are sort of a bridge between the two groups. And therefore, we feel that we can bring about some peace among them. And we stand for unity. We stand for integration. We stand for harmony. We stand for acceptance of each other so that we can live as one nation in this country.
How hard is it as a pastor of a church and a people in an area of the world where it seems that hate seems to prevail? How hard is it for you to carry out your job?
It is very difficult because our Christian principles are not accepted. The majority are Buddhist and the other majority, the next majority are Hindus. Therefore, they are not led by our own values. Our values are different and we all feel one people, one brothers and sisters, and that we have to accept each other's as we are and accept each other's rights and also their duties so that we can live together as one people.
A very important part of the church's work in the Jaffna Peninsula and indeed throughout Sri Lanka is, of course, education. There you go into the poor villages, you go into the areas of the jungle, you try to educate the Tamil people as to their identity and their rights. How important is education in fighting, combating poverty and in fighting and combating division in Sri Lanka?
Education is very important because through education we can alleviate the poverty and for the development and the progress of the people, education is very important here. Through education, we can remove the poverty level and also make them industrious and also self-employed, etc. And also to seek employment anywhere else because of their education they have received. And also, education is necessary so that we accept the others. Learned to value the other people, their traditions, etc. And also to act responsibly, not to sit down and negotiate, not fight like animals, not to take up to violence, but accept the others with understanding and love.
That was Sri Lankan bishop from Jaffna, Thomas Savundarana Yagam, speaking there to Emma McCarthy. Now, on a totally different note, next week, on the 11th of February, it's the 80th anniversary of the signing of the Lateran Pacts. To mark this special date, I'd like you to step back in time with me to a different era, that of the papacy of Pius XI, who, for the record, was elected as 258th successor of Peter on the 12th of February 1922, and who died on the 10th of February 1939, 10 years following the signing of these pacts I just mentioned. I'll be doing this in a very personal manner, by shining the spotlight on the years leading up to this date and those immediately following it, dipping both into the sound archives of Vatican Radio and into my own archives, bringing you the voices of some of those who were there. Beginning with Pius XI, of course, in a somewhat crackly recording of the time.
Mentre milioni di uomini vivono ancora in ansia per l'incombente pericolo.
The voice of Pope Pius XI, a voice Count Carlo Cardelli remembered very well.
Pius XI was very impressive. He spoke very slowly and with a very dignified attitude. But he was very solemn because he was very dogmatic, always sort of correcting himself, very attentive to the choice of his words, saying, as we should say better, to say it more precisely, in other words, what we mean to say is, therefore, in his court, they called him il professore.
Count Cardelli's family belonged to the papal aristocracy, so as a young man he was often received in audience by the Pope. He remembered being struck by the more scholarly side to Pope Pius XI, the fact he was a keen scientist, a librarian, and indeed former prefect of the Vatican Library. Others, like Princess Orietta Doria Pamphili, were impressed by the seemingly contradictory side to the papal personality. The intellectual Pope with the shiny spectacles was also a man of action and a sportsman.
Pius the 11th was Pope then, the Paparatti, and he was a great mountaineer, of course.
What is your memory of him as a person?
Oh dear, I never thought of it. I think he was sort of fairly stocky, a mountaineer build, really, a fairly stocky man, and energetic, yes. I remember going to an audience as a child. I can't think why I was taken along. And in those days, all the children wore white, and the ladies all wore black. It was a private order, of course. You had a black dress down to your feet. And the men had a morning coat, or at least a dark suit. And it usually was a Bachamano audience.
What is a Bachamano audience?
With the private audience, I think you sort of sit in his study. A big audience is when you all sit in rows on benches. And the Bachamano, a row of people round the room, and the Pope comes in, and literally you kiss his hand as he goes past you. And he'd say a few words to people here or there or to each family or group or whatever.
Was this an important part in your life, the audience with the Pope, or was it a regular feature in your life?
Oh, no, it was the only time I think I remember going to an audience. I mean, we weren't a black family. We weren't all connected with the Vatican in any way. In fact, we used to get the invitation to the tribune of the Roman nobility, then my father declined it at one stage.
You speak about the black aristocracy as opposed to the white aristocracy. Can you explain?
1870, when Rome became the capital of Italy, the Pope retreated to the Vatican. The black nobility, the ones that shut their doors on the state, on the Italian state, and stuck with the Pope, and the white were the ones who went with the state. And as my great-grandfather was the first deputy mayor of Rome in 1870, of course, we were with the state and not with the Vatican.
It was 1870, and unlike the Doria Pamphili family, Marquis Mario Teodoli's family did stand with the Pope, Not only did that mean they were part of the black aristocracy, but that his father was a colonel of Pius XI's noble guard, who made quite sure his family was present in St. Peter's Square when a pope was elected.
The noble guards represented a high class guardian of the name of the pope and the pope, and they followed the pope. So go to Piazza San Pietro when the pope was nominated. I remember it was Pius XI who was the first one who, after being elected pope, blessed the Roman population that was standing in Piazza San Pietro. I think that was the first time that he walked into that balcony and blessed the population here. The other folks before that never did that.
Pius XI's first gesture was unexpected. A pope had not appeared on the balcony looking out towards St. Peter's Square towards the Italian state since 1870. Despite being taken by surprise at seeing the pope appear at a window that had been closed to Italy for 52 years, the crowds lost no time in cheering, and more astonishingly, the Italian troops responded to the gesture by presenting arms. It was to be the first in a long line of decisive gestures Pius XI was to make in an effort to pave the way to a reconciliation between church and state. The Italian state Pius XI had to deal with was a fascist one. Mussolini had marched on Rome during the first year of the Pope's pontificate.
Di terra, di mare, dell'aria.
And 3 years later, during a ceremony in St. Peter's Basilica to mark the holy year of 1925, the Italian state was represented by a member of the fascist party. On this occasion, Count Carlo Cardelli witnessed what could have been a diplomatic incident.
It was very, very impressive. We entered the tribune reserved to the Roman nobility much in advance, and we had to wait a long time. I remember one episode which risked to become a diplomatic incident. The ambassador to the Holy See of Italy, the first ambassador of Italy to the Holy See, was Cesare Maria De Vecchi, the Valcismone, one of the quadrumviri of Mussolini, and he arrived late. There was no place for him, but he was entitled to be, I think, the first in rank. So they produced very quickly a chair, and he was sitting near and before the dean of the diplomatic corps, and looking very crossed.
4 years after this episode, on the 11th of February 1929, Pius XI became the last of the five popes to be a prisoner in the Vatican. On a rigid and rainy day, Mussolini for the Italian state and Cardinal Gasparri for the Holy See signed the Lateran Pacts. The bells rang out from the council hall in the Lateran Palace. From that day, Vatican City became an independent state. Catholicism was declared the only state religion, and a financial agreement between church and state was reached. Pius XI was satisfied. He'd finally settled the Roman question, and is said to have remarked, "I have given Italy back to God, and God back to Italy." But despite the Concordat, it took Pius XI a while before he left the Vatican. And when he eventually did so, it was in secret.
One day, we came back, our contramember I had been, I came back to the embassy, and I found consternation. The Pope had disappeared. It was around 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. The Pope had disappeared.
Father John Charleroux, son of the French ambassador to the Holy See at the time of Pius XI, recalled the general amazement in Vatican circles when one evening the Pope suddenly disappeared.
Anyway, around dinner time, the message came that the Pope was in Castel Gandolfo. And what had happened, it's that the Pope had been given Castel Gandolfo, which had belonged to the Prince Barberini before, when I was a small child in my first stay in Rome, by the Lateran Treatise. A summer residence, the Italian state kicked out the Barberinis and gave that to the Pope. But the Pope had taken such, was so accustomed to be closed up in the Vatican, that it took him from 1929 to 1934, 35, I'm not very vague in my memory, but all those years before he decided to move and to attempt to go out of Rome and to go to Castel Gandolfo. Nevertheless, the change was considered so great that he tried to do it secretly. And so it was in hot weather already. He chose the hour where everybody was doing what they call in Rome ora scabrosa, because everybody is having their siesta. And he put on the black cassock that he always had hanging in his room, with which he had climbed Monte Rosa as a young priest. He was very proud of that. And with his secretary, he ordered a car, not a papal car, to go secretly when everybody was asleep to Castel Gandolfo. It so happened that around Grottaferrato, I don't know where, the car broke down. The secretary, not wanting to say who was in the car, had went to fetch for help. One couldn't mend the car. To cut a long story short, it ended by a couple of ox being towing the car to Castel Gandolfo. So it took them all that time to reach Castel Gandolfo. It gives you the atmosphere of what, still, after the Treaty of the Latins, was the relation of Rome to the Italian state.
I hope you enjoyed that feature I put together for you. Finally, it's time to join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster. Father, there's a sentence we've used so many times. It's all roads lead to Rome. Yeah. How'd you say that?
Omnes Romam viae perducunt.
That was the case at the time of the Romans, in the sense of the roads which we've spoken about before, like the Via Salaria, the Road of the Salt, etc. But today I'd like to speak about the maritime roads. They were great in commerce, the Romans.
Well, they learned from the Phoenicians.
From the Phoenicians.
The Phoenicians.
Yes, not the Venetians.
The Phoenicians. They were the maritime people, and the Greeks. The Romans didn't have anything, you know. They were, again, they were way, way behind. They're not maritime people.
They were lagging behind. How do you say that?
Deficiebant. Deficiebant. And the fact is, they had to learn all these things, and they saw, like with the Carthaginians. The Carthaginians were maritime people. And in the famous wars with Hannibal and stuff, the Carthaginians would come out with fleets of 50, 60 ships. The Romans had one or two stupid old boats. They didn't know what to do.
Yeah, the Hollywood films and, show
in
us.
In the end, of course, then when Romans said, listen, friend, we better get the thing moving. Oh, it's very dramatic when we go out to Ostia, because there at Ostia, they were launching like about 30 ships a day. The Romans, when they got organized, And they were launching ships out into the Mediterranean on the Tiber River because they had to do something with the Carthaginians. The Romans didn't know anything about maritime business, nothing.
So it started as a defense system, no?
Well, yeah, well, certainly, yes. They knew about commerce in the East, and the Mediterranean was full of boats anyway, ships. But then, of course, the 200s there, 264... They started with the Carthaginians, and it was a matter of survival or not. Mm. And they did, and it was incredible. They out on the beach there, you know, Ostia out on the beach, they had benches set up, and they had people learning how to row in the sand.
How'd you say row?
Remigare. And they had a man who would keep time and stuff. The poor Romans didn't know anything.
How'd you say the Romans were practicing rowing in the sand?
Exercebant remigandi artem.
With a stopwatch?
Okay. Horologio indicativo.
Okay. You got around that.
Yeah, I got around that one. But anyway, and so the Romans were way, in everything they were way behind. But once they caught on to the things, then they were terrific. Like Pompeius, this is in the year 65 BC, they gave Pompeius permission, let's say, or authority to clear out the whole Mediterranean of pirates. The pirates came out to Ostia and were devastating the Romans out at Ostia. That's how bad that was. Talk about terrorism.
How do you say pirates?
Pirate or... Pirate is on the sea, yeah, exactly. And so what happened in 100 days, in 100 days, I think it was 3 months, Pompeius cleared the Mediterranean Sea. This is from Gibraltar out to Palestine.
How do you say that in Latin?
Of pirates. And that was it. Had them all crucified.
Blitz. Had them crucified.
Well, anyway, they just demolished them. And he had permission to go into the land, like 50 miles. He'd pursue the pirates. Bing, get them all strung up. That was the end of it. But in 3 months, he cleared the Mediterranean.
Who was he?
Pompeius Magnus.
So can you tell me in Latin?
Rival of Caesar.
Can you tell me in Latin? Pompeius Magnus blitzed the
blitzed.
Seas. Blitzed. The seas, the Mediterranean Sea.
Tamquam fulmine perpur gavit.
Of pirates?
Perpur gavit piratis mare medium. Perpur gavit. Well, liberavit, he freed.
And had the pirates crucified?
Well, yeah. Curavit affigendos, well, suspendendos.
That was the normal way of...
Well, yeah, it's just like normal administration, you know, like... You know, the electric chair in Texas today. You know,
How would you say electric chair in Texas in Latin?
Sedes electrica in Texia. I mean, so they had no problems there, but I'm trying to say that in 100 days, with his ships and his organization and the Roman fleet, they cleared out the whole Mediterranean from Gibraltar. You couldn't do that today.
Special thanks this week to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist, to whom I personally wish a speedy recovery. That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks very much for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.